All right, I might as well do the introductions to the barristers now, rather than as we go along. Now, anyone that doesn't know Sam has been, I suggest, living in the Gobi Desert in a yurt. He's, apart from being a very active property lawyer, he has a very busy blog and a lot of followers and puts up regular blogs. That blog's modestly called the Sam Hopper Blog. James Mackay has a general commercial practice with an emphasis on property law. He's also a consultant author of CCH's Victorian Conveyancing Law and Practice with Justice Croft. Richard Antle he's a general commercial barrister, but has particular expertise in personal property securities issues and also does a fair bit of property law. From 2010 to 2012, Richard took leave from the bar to take a position of risk manager at the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee, and as part of that role, he was responsible for educating practitioners about the Personal Property Securities Act 2009. So I suggest that if you have questions about that incomprehensible piece of legislation, you should ask them.
Look, the reason why we've chosen to speak on this topic this morning is that it can create some practical difficulties. It's the kind of case where you'll be dealing with quite often a situation where there'll be a tenant that's well behind in its rent. You've got a landlord that's already been throwing good money after bad in terms of seeking advice as to evictions, potentially hiring locksmiths to get rid of the tenant who's not paying the rent. Upon effectuating that re-entry, then the landlord may come in and find all kinds of goods that have been left there on the premises. The goods may have a significant value in the eyes of the tenant or a third party, but more often than not to the landlord, they're of little value and immense inconvenience. That's something they want to get out of their hair as quickly as possible in order to vacate the premises properly and re-let it to somebody else. Their first inclination is basically to hire a skip and just get rid of the goods and move on. They're then told by you that, in fact, they've got a much higher duty at law to act really as custodian of the goods and to not dispose of them or deal with them in any way until the rightful owner can be ascertained and that there's risk of tortious liability if they contravene those obligations. And they're also told that there's a procedure or a regime that's set out in the statute for the detention and sale of the goods that can take some time to effectuate and that can bog the whole process down and make it quite a headache for a number of months. So, long story short, it's a situation where you're likely to experience a degree of tension with the client, if nothing else. The client's going to want a simple and quick solution to move forward, and you're going to be having to recommend that all these rules are followed to make sure that there's no violation of law and no risk of liability either to yourself and your client. And it's a situation where there's significant pressure to cut corners, if you will. That makes a reminder of some of these rules that govern the area quite necessary, and we've seen that it's an area that can change quite rapidly in terms of legislative intervention. We've had part 4.2 of the Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act that's now apparently been designed to lay down a general procedure, not just for goods that are left on site in the case of a landlord and tenant situation, but also generally where there's a bailment in a commercial situation. And as we'll be discussing, there's some difficult issues as to whether and how that legislation applies in this particular context and some of the issues arising under it. Before we even get to that, though, there's also some basic problems, if you like, or really some reminders of basic aspects of the law that relate to this area that are well worth considering from the outset and just touching on so we have some context for the discussions that come later on, particularly through the other speakers. So to go through some of those basic aspects which derive mostly from the common law but also from statutes such as the now repealed Landlord and Tenant Act and also the Property Law Act, we can consider some of those issues. The first barely needs stating, but it's a good starting point, which is that the tenant owns the goods obviously that are movable and that are left at the premises, and they're the tenants to remove during the course of the lease. The landlord does not acquire any kind of title to the goods merely because the possession given to the tenant ends either by the expiry of the lease due to a fluxion of time or the determination of the lease due to other means. So lease comes to an end, the landlord doesn't by that by virtue of that fact alone, acquire any right to the goods. The goods are a separately owned thing, and all of the usual consequences of law in terms of the torts of conversion and debt and you all apply in favour of the owner of those goods. Now, of course, that's subject to the common law rules of abandonment, which, as we know, are full of ambiguity and can lead to all kinds of situations where you're not really sure whether an abandonment has occurred or not and whether that requisite intention can be showed objectively in terms of the person evincing once and for all an intention to leave the goods at the site. Now, that common law uncertainty is often alleviated to some degree by abandonment clauses that are contained in the terms of the lease, and they'll say things like, if the tenant leaves goods on the site at the expiry of the lease or its termination, then those goods are treated as being abandoned. Now, they help to some degree in terms of making clear that the abandonment is deemed to occur quite quickly after the termination of the lease, but they've also been seen to give rise to problems, these clauses. You have situations, particularly in VCAT matters, where they're smaller leases and, you know, retail tenancies, where you have landlords that read the lease and then construe those clauses literally and treat them as some kind of warrant to basically detain the goods and exercise a right analogous to distress, where they're saying you're not collecting your goods until you pay the rent that's owing or some other amount owing under the lease. Now, usually the clause won't support such action because there won't be any abandonment that actually occurs unless there's been some voluntary act by the tenant to leave the goods on the site and actually carry out an abandonment similar to the common law concept. For example, if there's a determination where a re-entry occurs and the tenant still has some goods on site because they've not had time to simply go in there and get those goods out, then by that fact alone, they're not going to be treated as having left the goods on site so that the abandonment clause will operate. So there's been two decisions, at least recently in VCAT, where quite substantial claims for conversion have been levelled against landlords and have succeeded in circumstances such as this. With conversion as well, it's important to remember that the cause of action is made out once, or in contexts like this anyway, once the landlord gives some kind of firm and final indication that they're not going to hand over the goods after having been requested to do so by the tenant. So you can have situations where, due to some confusion, such as in the situation I've discussed, where the landlord might think he or she does have a right to retain the goods because of this abandonment clause, he or she then says, well, no, I'm not going to hand over the goods. You still owe me rent. You're treated as having abandoned. I'm keeping those goods for the moment. At that point, proceedings for conversion can be issued. And once the landlord realises that they're in the wrong, the litigation can already be on foot. And whilst it's been held in VCAT, there is a discretion to give back the goods and to basically bring an end to the conversion suit at the discretion of the tribunal. That's something that's a discretion rarely exercised, because if the goods change value in any way, then the tribunal will say, well, things have changed, the conversion suit should succeed. And in such circumstances, the tenant will recover the full market value of the goods. So there's sort of some tricky issues there as a starting point. The goods have a title that's vested in somebody else, and that title has to be respected to avoid that tortious liability. Now, some of the other speakers will be touching on the doctrine of distress and the abolition of that doctrine, and some law that's really come up recently to replace the right of distress. Distress was a right to basically take detention of the goods during the term of the lease, really a security to compel payment of rent. That is something that is abolished. So it's not something you can do inherently, and it's something that you can't use as a common law right to bolster the abandonment clauses I've just discussed. Now, conversely, there's a question as to what happens once an abandonment has occurred or get to a point where the goods have remained on site for a sufficient time where you can say that it's quite clear that the tenant is not intending to come back and collect, or at least that may be an inference you can draw in the circumstances. And it may also be that there's no claim that's been levied by any third parties that you have notice of no interest recorded in the PBSR register, things like that. So you think that you're basically right to dispose of the goods. There's a difficult question as to whether the regimes that I'll shortly discuss in the Landlord and Tenant Act and now Part 4 of the Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act are compulsory regimes. Those regimes require the storage and sale of the goods, and there's a question as to whether the common law right that a landlord would have outside those regimes to simply dispose of abandoned goods is ousted by the statute. I think certainly that the better view is that those statutory regimes do not do away with the landlord's right to dispose of the goods once that landlord acquires title to the goods by abandonment, particularly Part 4.2, the new legislation that's been drafted to deal with uncollected goods, makes it clear that the common law rights that a landlord has or that any recipient of goods has to deal with them is not affected by the Act unless there's some kind of necessary ouster given rise to by the Act. So in this case, there's a fair argument to say that if you're really, really certain as landlord or as advisor to a landlord that goods have been abandoned once and for all and you have the abandonment clause in the lease, that you may just well be able to dispose of those goods because they're the landlord's property. But the reason why the statutes are resorted to so frequently and why we so rarely see instances where that occurs is because it's just too risky, because if you do get a claim down the track, then you can have a substantial liability in conversion. Now, in terms of the tenant's rights to actually collect the goods, obviously the tenant has the right during the lease to collect the goods, but there's a question and an issue as to how long, if at all, that right extends to once the lease comes to an end. It has been held that in circumstances where the lease ends suddenly, either due to a re-entry or perhaps due to the fact that the lease term is uncertain, it might be a life tenancy, for example, and it comes to an end without warning, in circumstances such as that, the tenant can in fact come onto the land and take possession of their goods for a short period of time after the lease comes to an end. Now, that proposition is cited in text without any real discussion or qualification. It must be said, I see some risk in cases where the lease has ended and possession is reverted to the landlord, in the tenant who has a key or something like that coming in and actually sort of forcibly taking possession of the land for a brief time to get their goods out of that premises. I find that quite a radical proposition, and I'd submit that probably the better view is that this common law right to access that property for the short time afterwards is really like a common law implied license. And if there is any real disputation or dissent from the landlord, then the best course is to simply seek an order from VCAT or to make a common law demand for the goods. That is the other way, of course, to get possession of the goods if you're the tenant. You simply make a demand, which can be oral or in writing. Once that demand is made upon the landlord and they refuse to hand the goods over, then the action for conversion can be brought at that time. Now, just quickly, there's issues with what goods exactly these rules apply to. Of course, not all goods are movable chattels. We have fixtures as well that are installed at the property. Sometimes what is a fixture or an installation belonging to one of the parties will be made clear by the lease, so you'll have a tenant's installation that's recorded as such in the schedule of the lease. In other situations, the common law will assist in determining the rules there. I don't plan on going into the laws of fixtures, that's fairly well known to you, but one point that is worth making is the landlord and tenant context within that law has some special rules that don't apply generally. Whilst in a normal case where something is affixed to land, it is part of the land and ordinarily owned by the person who owns the land, it being one indistinguishable whole. In the law of landlord and tenant, there is a right on the part of a tenant to come into the land, even after the lease is determined, to remove those fixtures that they've installed there in the course of their trade. There's also legislation now in section 28, subparagraph 2 of the Landlord and Tenant Act, which has recently been replaced by section 154A of the Property Law Act. That basically says that the fixtures that are installed by the tenant during the course of the lease are the property of the tenant and can be dealt with as such by the tenant. So that has implications in terms of third-party interest, charges, transfers, all those things. Things that are installed at the land as fixtures are owned by the tenant. They're not fixtures in the traditional sense that are fused with the land. They can be dealt with and charged and offered as security individually and separately. I'll hand over to Sam Pollard. Thank you.
I should just say that, James, there will be a paper. I understand it's not in your bundle. James will have a paper which will be sent out to you. It's quite detailed.
Morning, everyone. On this fine spring morning, I'm just going to give you... Well, thanks, James, for that very excellent and detailed summary of the law in this area. I thought a good addition to James's paper might be to give you a few examples, some real-world examples of issues that have arisen in my practice over the years, arising out of goods left behind by tenants after the termination of the lease. So I thought I'd go through four examples with that are loosely based on real examples with some changes to protect my clients who are innocent, and leave you with a few things to think about. Firstly, the first example is what I like to refer to as my very risk-averse landlord. And this is the first one of these I ever dealt with when I was an article clerk or maybe a first-year solicitor at Minter Ellison. And my client was a government corporation, government landlord corporation. We could call it TricVac for short. And it had large amounts of land around Victoria, mostly close to railways, and it had leased a small warehouse to a lady, and I would refer to her as a female valise and reticule and portmanteau enthusiast, which I think is a very polite description for a bag lady. And she was quite colourful. And when she abandoned the property, my client re-entered in the normal way. I opened the doors, and of course it was full of years' worth of collected paraphernalia. And the first inclination was to turf all of this stuff in the bin because it didn't seem to have much value. But being a government client, they were understandably cautious. And as they sort of took stock and worked out what to do with the stuff that was left behind, word filtered through from the local member that she had appeared at his office and started to bang on the door, shout and scream about the extremely valuable bracelet that was a family heirloom that was in there and the unicorn. And we don't know at this stage whether the unicorn was a pendant on the bracelet or whether it was in fact a flesh and blood unicorn that she'd left behind. It got a little bit more complicated because the local member happened to be the premier. So the government client was understandably concerned both about its own relationship with the premier and a media incident for the premier's office if the client decided to go to current affair or something like that. So we were instructed that this client was ultra-conservative, completely risk-averse in relation to these goods and didn't want to do anything that could expose either it or the Department of Premier to criticism. So we advised it to engage a real estate agent, a reputable local managing agent, to go down to the property, photograph, video and catalogue every item that was there. Serve the required notices under the Landlord and Tenant Act and then wait the required 3-month period before disposing of the goods, then to dispose of them by public auction in separate lots so that there was no issue about the value of them. We of course found then that we couldn't locate our female valise, reticule and portmanteau enthusiast. So we were instructed to engage a private investigator to try and locate her. they spent an extraordinary amount of time and money trying to locate her, still couldn't find her. After the 3 month period elapsed, they still weren't comfortable disposing the goods, so they put into storage. And I think after about 9 or 10 months, eventually the client was comfortable with disposing of these goods. Now, I think they were put up for public auction. None of them had any value, and they were I think they were just chucked in the bin. Now, the real estate agent, the managing agent, was tearing his hair out. He thought, this is uncommercial, it's ridiculous, what are you doing? Client, very, very happy, risk-averse client. We put a procedure in place that satisfied all of their, that addressed all of his anxieties about what could happen with this particular person. He went beyond the call of duty in terms of his legal obligations. He waited 3 times the period required under the Landlord and Tenant Act, and they attempted to sell the goods, and he was completely above reproach and beyond any criticism. So that's a risk-averse landlord at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, I have who I would refer to as my very risky landlord. This fellow had a warehouse type of thing that was leased to a tenant who was using it for a trade, and he had both fit out in the form of air conditioning and venting facilities, and he also had machinery, plant equipment in there. The tenant abandoned, and soon after he abandoned, the liquidator was appointed to the tenant company, and the landlord re-entered, took possession, found that the tenant had walked out and left all of his plant and equipment there. It was quite valuable. The landlord said, I wouldn't mind keeping it for myself, but also I want to use the space and I want to use it quickly. His lease did not contain a clause dealing with goods left behind. Okay, so we had to revert back to the Landlord and Tenant Act. So he said, what do I do? I said, all right, well, why don't you start the ball rolling by writing to the liquidator and saying, get rid of this stuff if it's of value to the company. Liquidator wrote back and said, he said, firstly, the plant and equipment belongs to a related company, full stop, didn't say who the related company was. He then said, and by the way, there are a series of charges over the company's assets, some of them to major lenders, full stop. We don't know which assets belong to which related company, we don't know which assets are under which charge, and we don't know whether which lenders are the subject of the charge. Found out who the lenders were by going through an ASIC search, but we're still in the dark as to who owned what. Landlord's tearing his hair out. He says, I want to use this property because and I can't use it while it's there. I said, well, under the law, you're a bailee of the goods. Can you put them into a warehouse? And if anyone makes a claim on them, claim the costs of storage from them. He said that's going to cost me a bomb, and the act of removing half this stuff is going to render this whole thing uncommercial. So he's furious. I said, all right, well, what do you want to do? He said, I want to sell the stuff and I want to keep the money. All right. Well, you're in breach of your obligations. If you do that, you're going to face, you're at risk of a damages claim against the true owner of these goods. One of those true owners may well be a lender, and they tend to be a little bit unforgiving in these circumstances. He said, I don't care. I said, I'm going to do it anyway. I said, all right, it's your risk, not mine. Put that in writing. Everybody's comfortable. I then said, all right, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. What you should do is catalogue each item, photograph it, video it, keep a list of it. If you're going to sell them by public auction. Make sure there's an appropriate advertising campaign. That way there's a proper market sale of the goods. If anyone ever comes back looking to you, to attack you, then one, you've got evidence of the true market value of the goods. Two, you've got evidence of what goods were in fact there, photo, video, and a list. Two, you've got evidence of the market value of the goods, so you can at least mitigate your damage if somebody sues you. He then promptly ignored that advice, did none of those things, put the goods straight on the market, sold them to somebody that he knew, kept the money, and no one sued him afterwards. Right? Lawyers hate that sort of stuff. But it's typical landlord's practical solution to a bit of a legal mess, particularly when you've got to wait 3 months under the Landlord and Tenant Act before you dispose of uncollected goods. The lesson for us out of that is give your client, if your client wants to do it, that's fine. Give them the options, tell them what their risks are, tell them how to mitigate their loss by cataloguing the items and having them sold by public auction so you know what the proper market rate is, what market value of the goods is. Next, I'm getting the wind-up from Robert, so I'll be as quick as possible. There's two other things I want to tell you about. Well, in fact, I'll just tell you about one and we'll leave the other one to question time. The last one is my creative landlord. And he was a fellow who'd got himself into a real jam with a classic rogue tenant. He'd leased a space to a car park operator. And for some reason, car park operators and car wash operators always seem to be infested by rogue tenants. Now, this bloke had moved in and had operated for something like 18 months to 2 years without paying rent ever. This bloke had let it run up for 2 years, and he comes to me, he's tearing his hair out, and says, "I don't know what to do." I said, "Well, you re-enter and you terminate the lease." He says, "Firstly, I don't know who the tenant is, because sometimes it's the corporation, sometimes it's a natural person." So, let's just terminate against both of them. He says, "Yeah, but the car park's full of cars. This car park is a long-term car park that's a couple of metres away from the airport, and people park their car for months. So if I re-enter and terminate and lock the bloke out, I'm stuck with all of these cars sitting there and I've got to get them out." I said, "Yeah, but you're faced with a tenant who's not paying any rent." He said, "So what do I do?" I said, well, "Why don't you go in and operate the car park yourself?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to do that because this bloke's got underworld connections and I reckon he's going to turn up with a shotgun." I said, "All right." So we sat down, we devised a strategy for him, and the strategy was this. One, contact the local police before the re-entry and liaise with airport staff so that the customer service staff around the airport know what's happening and can direct people with their queries. Two, get a security company in. The security company arranged for 24/7 security guards to be posted for at least 3 weeks after the re-entry with the possibility of extending it further. Then when you re-enter in the usual way against both the company and the individual. And then erect a great big cyclone wire fence around the place so that you can secure it. Then get your security guards there 24/7 with a clipboard, and every time someone comes up to collect a car, make sure that you get the license plate of the car, either their passport or their driver's license number, and any other identifying details that you can, and release the car to them only after the security guard has been satisfied that the car's going to the right person. Now, once we put this strategy in train, the company was placed into liquidation. The liquidator told us that he didn't want to continue to operate the car park, so that sort of eliminated part of the risk associated with the thing. The strategy was put into place. After about 3 weeks, the bulk of the cars were gone, and a new car park operator who was had some police checks went in and is operating the car park, and everything went very, very smoothly. So again, a creative and active way to resolve a difficult quagmire that this bloke had got himself into. And although it cost the landlord a lot of money to get himself out of that situation because he had to get the fence and the security guards in, it was better than continuing with this lunatic tenant who hadn't been paying rent for over a year and a half. All right, I've got the lineup, so thank you for listening. I hope those examples are you.